On the Empire Podcast this week, we talk mobsters with Stephen Graham, one of the stars of Martin Scorsese's roller coaster ride through American history, The Irishman.
Marty went, right, okay, so, well, do you want to do this, kid? I was like, yeah, of course I do, yeah.
And we brave the master of disaster, Roland Emmerich, as he returns with World War II drama Midway.
I'm always drawn to kind of bigger canvases, you know, lots of characters.
All this and the usual movie news, views and nonsense on the only movie podcast that considered reanimating James Dean to co-host today, but decided that that would be a fucking dreadful idea. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Your usual host, Chris Hewitt, is off on a well-earned staycation this week in glamorous London, so I've stepped into the hosting hot seat and found it honestly unpleasantly warm, as if someone's just left. But I'm joined anyway by not two, not three, but one colleague of such lethal cunning in the shape of West Wing stand James Dyer, which is nice, I guess. Hello, James.
I am entirely devoid of cunning this week because I'm not sure how useful I'm going to be, having seen absolutely none of the films out this week, though I do have a very good excuse. So,
really,
my absence for the last two podcasts was largely down to the fact I was trying to do interviews and write the cover feature for the new issue, which goes to press next week. I will not say what that is, but people will find out very, very soon. And so I've been sort of in interviewing, writing, travelling hell as I get all this sort of done. But as a result of that, I also haven't seen any of the fucking films. So I'm just going to be like, oh, so Helen, tell me about The Irishman. Is it very Irish? Did you enjoy that?
Spoiler, not Irish enough.
Wow.
But luckily for the listeners, we have actually drafted in help.
Nick People who watch films.
Nick DeSemlin's going to join us a little bit later to talk about some of the films in review. Yes. And I've seen some, so at least we're
And Nick basically covered. Made The Irishman. So.
He basically did. He covered that so extensively. And of course, you should have read all
but
about
I've,
it.
But I've tried to have balance. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't see Scorsese's The Irishman, so I rewatched Captain Marvel instead, because I think that's what Marty would have wanted.
Well, let's hope so. It's been a busy week, I think it's fair to say, and that's fine, and we're just going to power through as best we can and deal with it anyway.
I haven't even watched all the shows for Pilot, but don't tell anyone.
I'm pretty sure nobody heard that. I think it'll be fine. But Keith will obviously be very upset. Shall we have a question?
Please don't make it about films. Yeah, sure, go for it.
Okay, this is a question that actually Chris really wanted us to talk about, and I feel like it might be quite hard, but we're going to try it anyway. So, at Handle Moff says, in honour of Criterion releasing the full 287-minute version of Until the End of the World, what is the longest movie that you enjoy or at least admire? Now, that's a pretty good question, given that this week's obviously The Irishman.
Yes.
Clocks in at, what is it, 214 minutes or so?
Yeah, it's long.
It's long.
I've heard, having not actually watched it.
Thanks, James. It's this kind of expert commentary that people come to Empire for. But yeah, longest movie that you enjoy or at least admire. I mean, I've done... Wow. You know, the Lord of the Rings extended cuts. So those are pretty hefty.
I mean, that's the fallback, isn't it? Because I was going to say, like, so the Dances with Wolves director's cut is pretty fucking long.
That's you
know,
long,
That's a long one. But I don't know that it beats out the extended editions. But Lord of the Rings ones, I feel, are... They're films that don't feel long. With the exception of Return of the King, of those three films, that's the only one I wouldn't recommend the extended
Hey, that
edition.
Is the best picture winner, dude.
But it's just like, because then the ending, the endings begin with literally an hour to go, and you're just like, this is just too much.
Something's gone wrong here.
Something's gone horribly wrong when the film finishes an hour before it finishes.
But that's with them actually cutting out an entire chunk of the ending and not doing the Scourging of the Shire, which thematically, I know I've said this before, is a super good idea, because otherwise you've got the hobbits coming home and finding that everything has also changed, whereas this way you've got the hobbits coming home and finding that the Shire hasn't changed, but they have, and that's why Frodo then can't settle, and it makes a lot more sense. But yeah, the book does kind of the same thing. Like, the end of Return of the King happens about halfway through Return of the King and then has all of that left to go.
Not one for structural Tolkien, was he?
Well, he had his own rules, I guess. He was very into language structure, obviously. That was the whole point.
Yeah, he loved a song.
He did love a song and a poem.
But what are the long ones? I mean, I've never sat through all 12 hours of Shoah. I feel that would probably feel long.
It's one of those ones, sometimes you feel like certain movies are almost a penance. It's like, I haven't been through this incredibly awful experience, but I feel like I owe it.
I owe it to them to sit through this 12-hour documentary.
This documentary, and I mean, that sounds very flippant of me, and I don't intend it as such, but it almost is a way of paying some kind of respect to those who went through real hardship.
Well, I now feel terrible.
Yeah, sorry about that. Also, you are terrible.
Thank you.
But yeah, I've watched things that have then been chopped up into sort of, you know, the TV episode kind of things, you know, the sort of Das Boot long version, but then cut into chunks. I haven't I'll be honest, sat through it all in one go. The Ken Burns Vietnam documentary as well, same thing. I didn't do that all at once. I kind of treated it like a TV show.
9 hours and 26 minutes, Shah. Sorry, not 12. That was me exaggerating. 9 hours and 26 minutes. God, yeah. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for the longest films. And the longest is Amra Ekta Cinema Banabo, brackets The Innocents, which clocks in at 21 hours and 5 minutes.
I'll be honest, I've missed that one. I probably won't catch up on it anytime soon.
21 hours and 5 minutes, and I reckon it probably goes by faster than Ad Astra.
Hey, yeah. Ad Astra has made my top 10 of the year list.
Oh, God, did it?
Yes.
Really?
100%.
So we had to hand these in today. It's our top 10s of the year list. They are completely anonymous, so the fact that I haven't seen The Irishman yet will never be known, except I've just said it. But yeah, so that was an interesting exercise, because this year has been a surprising year in the big films like Endgame, whatnot, but also lots of really nice, awesome little films that you get properly excited about that actually you think, do you know what? I want this at the top of my list. You know, Booksmart, which no one went to see for shame because it's fabulous.
It's amazing. I'll be honest, the top four on my list are completely interchangeable. I went with an order. They could be in any order and I would be totally happy. They're essentially a joint first.
Ooh. Well, I can guess two of them, definitely.
Yes. Yeah, you can.
The other two, that's tricky.
One of them I think you haven't seen yet, so. It's not The Irishman.
That doesn't really narrow it down, does it, Helen?
Anyway, we're spoiling the Review of the Year podcast here.
So come back later for Review of the Year and we'll talk about this properly.
We always put that up between Christmas and New Year. You should definitely come back for that.
I promise to have seen some films before we do Review of the Year. I honestly will.
While I'm talking about special episodes of the podcast, just very quickly, let me remind you that a bunch of our spoiler specials have gone live. The Joker special, which somehow got through the system without me in it, is up and there for your listening pleasure now. We also have great spoiler specials from all through the summer, about 16 bajillion for Endgame alone. We have a fantastic Yesterday spoiler special with Richard Curtis talking about that film. We have kind of the plethora, an absolute gamut of sports
even
specials
more
for
than
you
that,
to listen to.
Here's a public service announcement. Uh-oh. We migrated, this is a very exciting technical announcement, we migrated to a new podcast hosting platform. But a happy side effect of this seems to be that all of the legacy podcasts, which have hitherto been unavailable because they dropped off the feed, have returned.
Hurrah.
So you can go all the way back, I think, now to episode one, but it means all of our historical spoiler specials are now available again.
And you can find out that we spent about 20 minutes on The Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
So that's pretty special. If you think that James means the legacy specials of the Marvel Phase 1 movies that we recorded, he doesn't. Those still haven't been edited and still aren't up. But you know what? This is a time of optimism. This is a time for hope. And I believe that one day Chris will find time.
I'm gonna try and make, we were talking about this, I'm trying to make Chris, we may or may not have a ranking for the greatest Star Wars movies, and we may or may not have done it when Solo came out, and it still isn't ready. But we're thinking maybe, and I was resisting this, but Chris has maybe convinced me, that we don't put it up, and instead we wait until Rise of Skywalker, and then do it then.
What?
So that we can place Rise of Skywalker in the list. So maybe that ranking won't go up, and we'll do an all-new Star Wars ranking when we've got all nine core films.
I'm just looking through the same list of longest films you did to get back to the question for a second.
Oh, yes, we had a question.
We did have a question. OJ Made in America, I thought that was terrific, and I watched all of that in pretty much a day. So maybe that's my answer in that case, because that is longer than The Lord of the Rings.
But then, you know, it depends on where we're going. I mean, we're in a very film territory. I've watched entire seasons of TV shows in a day. So
yes.
I've absolutely done like 15, 16-hour back-to-back jobs to get through a season of something in my sort of binging. So, you know.
Apparently they count binging as anything over 3 episodes in a day.
That's just normal TV watching. I don't understand.
That's barely anything.
I do more than that in my commute.
I know, right? Okay, so that was our answer, and our answer was Lord of the Rings, I think.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you would like your question treated with the same incisive, insightful analysis that one got, please do drop us a line. We're podcast@empireonline.com. On Twitter, we're @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag EmpirePodcast or we won't see it. And on Facebook, we won't check it, but if you want to, we're there as Empire Magazine. All right, I think time now for an interview. Roland Emmerich became known, of course, as the master of disaster with a string of huge-scale hits like Independence Day, Day After Tomorrow, Godzilla, 2012. But this week he's back with a subject that's a little bit closer to reality, tackling some of the real-life battles of the Pacific conflict of World War II in Midway. He sat down with Chris to talk about joining the Navy.
Delighted to be joined once again on the Emperor podcast by Roland Emmerich, director of Midway. Mm-hmm. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very good.
Excellent. Good to have you here. If you had had your way, we would have been talking about this movie, say, 20 years ago.
Yes. But luckily we don't, because at that time I think technology was not really as good as it is now. So I'm actually quite happy that it took so long, because I just think it would have been not as easy to do.
In what way?
Well, you know, I think water and explosions and smoke came a long way. And because of that, you know, it was doable. It was also doable for, let's say, you know, a better price. You know,
okay,
I mean,
yeah.
At that time, you remember when they like kind of did the Pearl Harbor, uh-huh. where they had like budget problems? It was mainly because
was
the visual
huge,
effects,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
were
yeah.
so, everything was like new and, you know, and they had to kind of cut their number of effects down. I think they could only do like roughly 300 effect shots, which we have in our movie, 1,500.
Wow. That's pretty
You know what
nice.
I mean? Yeah. That's like kind of naturally, you know, because of that, you know, that's why I say easier. I mean, it was still not easy, but it was just like kind of probably 20 years not possible
yeah.
to make this film.
Wow. And there's an awful lot of history, an awful lot of key points leading up to Midway that you have to condense and squeeze into this. Otherwise, this could easily be, it's a 2-hour movie,
yeah.
but it could easily be 3 hours, it could easily be 4 hours.
Yeah.
So how difficult was it to accordion that history into a 2-hour model?
Well, it was, I don't like long movies. That's just like kind of my personal taste. And I always try to condense movies as much as I can. And it was already in the script like this. We had a longer script. And very early on, I said, like, this is too long. Let's condense it to really what we need. And then at the end, maybe cut like another 2-3 scenes out, but not much.
Oh, really? Okay.
And we just condensed it, you know, like kind of by lines in a way. And I just like kind of thought, you know, we hit all the right points you have to hit.
Yeah, there's Pearl Harbor, there's Marshall Islands, building up to Midway as well. You have a huge cast of characters.
Mm-hmm.
There are scenes as well from the Japanese point of view. I mean, you're a director who is not, you're not new to ensemble casts and to juggling large casts of characters. Mm-hmm. But even so, was this a bit of a challenge for you?
Well, it was like kind of... You know, I mean, I'm always drawn to kind of bigger canvases, you know, lots of characters. All my movies, more or less, you know, like do that. And so it was not really for me a problem. It was like actually more a challenge to, because don't forget, in a war movie, everybody some sort of has the same clothes on.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So you have to kind of find people who are very quite different from each other. And that was a little bit of a challenge. And it was for me really, really important to make the movie evenly balanced.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have nearly like 25% or so is like kind of the Japanese angle of the whole story, because this was very important to understand why are the Japanese doing this at all and what like led them to lose the battle. The only real problem I had in this movie, I had to shoot it in 65 days.
Wow. Which and seems like a lot. But,
and
yeah.
I couldn't even do long days, which I tend to do normally. But just of budget restrictions, you know, we had not more money. We had no second unit.
Uh-huh.
So I shot a movie in 65 days.
Wow.
It was tough.
Yeah.
Because normally I'm always like... playing it a little bit safe, like a lot of directors do. So like in editing, you have like kind of ways to lose some stuff. But every scene was like kind of relatively starkly blocked exactly how it should have been cut. So I felt a little bit, you know, will this all work? And then it worked great. And now I'm like kind of thinking I'm doing all my movies in that kind of time.
No second unit, 65
yes,
days?
Yes, second unit I already gave up like 3-4 films ago
okay.
because I always hate everything what they shoot and then I throw it away. So...
Well, you're not alone there. I know Guillermo del Toro doesn't have a second unit. Edgar Wright doesn't like to have a second unit.
The older you get, the least you like second unit, trust me. Also, like it's good to not overwork a crew either. Because they, when they know they're getting out after 12 and a half hours,
mm-hmm.
that's a good thing, you know. And everybody works a little bit faster to make that happen. And I think the whole spirit on the set is better. And so I will probably do this in my, try to do this in my next movie too.
And your next movie, we'll get on to that in a few minutes as well. But is that Moonfall? Is that definitely going to be next for you?
Yes.
That sounds very exciting to do. But this one, Midway, I mean, this is the passion project. This, why have you stayed with this movie? Or why has this movie stayed with you for the
because
last 20 years?
Because it's such an interesting battle. It's such an interesting combination of situations. It also shows that at one point the Americans were the underdogs who had to kind of defeat a much stronger foe. And there was one element, and I liked the mix of politics and the whole naval intelligence part of it. And it is just like a big comeback story, which I really, really always like kind of felt that was a really interesting way to do a war movie, you know, where the characters themselves have doubts if they can do it. And then it's also like, I have to say, I was fascinated by dive bombing. Mm-hmm. Because it's such a, for us today, unknown thing that at one point we were like kind of putting two people in a missile. And it was not like kind of somebody kind of in a joystick like a video game doing the steering. No, they flew down like missiles on these kind of ever-moving aircraft carriers and deployed their bomb as late as possible, which led a lot to people hitting the water. And while they were doing it, like kind of 6, 7, 10 ships were shooting at them.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, some of the scenes of
that's what like kind of always like I think I always had the feeling already 20 years ago that this was for me like kind of one of the things I hadn't seen, because you always like in movies you try to do something what you haven't seen or haven't experienced, and that was always for me like the part which I kind of thought that nobody has experienced that.
So how did this movie change for you over that 20-year period? Did it go through different iterations
of
the script?
No, it was like kind of, I mean, there was never a script written. It was like around 5, 6 years ago. A young writer came into my office and was for other scripts, you know. And every young writer, I'm always asked, what is the script which is in you, which you have to write? And the guy, without even thinking, said Midway. And I said, why? And I said, because I come from a Navy family and I have a lot of respect for what they do. And I think Midway is the most amazing battle ever fought by the Americans. So I said, I totally agree. And we made like kind of this deal to develop the script together. First, we were like kind of probing how to do it, because I said to him, first he wanted to kind of invent stuff. And I said, like, I don't think, Wes, we have to invent anything. We have to kind of just stay with the battle and with the characters. And then it was quite difficult to choose the characters because there's so many. And it has a little bit of personal story for me. I have an uncle I never met, who had exactly the same experience than Dick Best had.
Okay.
He was a fighter pilot in World War II, and up and down like kind of affected his lungs, and he had latent tuberculosis. He didn't know about it.
Oh, wow.
And he died after the war because the medical facilities in Germany were destroyed. So for me, this was like kind of the when I like read, you know, about Dick Best, that immediately spoke to me.
That's fascinating, the idea of basing it on real characters as well. And I guess a character named like Dick Best, for example, has to be from history.
There was like
the
funny thing, like everybody who like kind of Googled Dick Best got on like kind of gay porn sites.
Okay, yeah.
But his name was Halsey, you know. You know, his name was Halsey Dick Best.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Okay. It's there. It is there. It's really interesting as well, Roland. I mean, you mentioned that you have this uncle that you never met. Obviously, this is a World War II story that focuses on America and Japan. Mm-hmm. Are you tempted at all to, have you ever been tempted to make a story that focuses on the German side of things?
Well, I'm always like kind of interested in doing a movie about Erwin Rommel.
Okay.
Because he comes from my homeland.
Yeah.
He's like Swabian like me. And he was in a fascinating character, and I have the feeling he in a way went through what Germany went through. He was like kind of at the beginning a fan of Hitler, you know, and at the end was part of the assassination attempt, you know. That was like kind of for me a journey which I kind of think was like is very interesting. One day maybe I will do it,
because I imagine The idea is that as we get further and further away from World War II, that it begins to fade in people's memories.
Yeah, and we have to be really careful about that. I tell you, it's like, and that's why I'm probably also happy I made the movie now, beside the technical sides of things. I think with the rise of nationalism more and more all over the world, this is not only America, this is Europe, the same thing, right-wing parties, you know, like kind of growing. I mean, that led us to a war, which cost like 50 million people's life. And you ask yourself, you know, this could very well happen. And I'm also like kind of very, very concerned, you know, that like kind of because of climate change, there will be more and more refugees in the future, not only like kind of 10 million, but like maybe 100 or 200 or 300 million. Yeah. And then we have to kind of be very, very strong because these people, it's not their fault. It's like it's the first world's fault that all this happened.
They were in this mess,
They were in this mess, and I hope that we're like, and I'm not a conservative in any form, but I was quite amazed that our Angela Merkel took in 1 million or more than 1 million refugees, you know, because that's actually the way to go.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's now 15 years since the day after tomorrow, which, despite the CG wolves and whatnot, is beginning to look more like a documentary with every passing day.
It's so funny, and like in every like storm. You know, like kind of these images of day after tomorrow, they use them and make them like kind of fake news. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then the best was like kind of when there was this like storm surge in New York, they used like the Empire State Building as like a that's funny.
It could happen. It could happen. And but it is strange. I mean, 15 years ago, you were making this movie. Even back then, I remember speaking to you about that, and you were even then ringing the bell.
And then I think... I obviously didn't ring it loud enough. I mean, it is amazing. It's amazing what's happening because we're not going in the right direction. And it's actually but what gives me hope is like finally kids go in the street.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real good development. But then they get ridiculed by like a guy like Trump, which is like super interesting what's happening. But only lately somebody from, I think was like kind of from Vanity Fair or somebody did some article about it and asked me, so why no more movies like that? And I said, well, it's like maybe there's a superhero is more interesting.
So we need a superhero who will fight global warming.
Yeah, but it's like not going to happen. You know what I mean? We're like kind of silly ourselves to death.
Yeah. So we focus too much on entertainment that we don't necessarily listen to the messages.
You can make it interesting and exciting and all these kind of things. I mean, when Hollywood put his mind to it, there could be a whole subgenre of like kind of environmental movies, you know.
But is there a responsibility there in that I believe that people are strangely more likely to listen to a movie or to the message put out by a movie than they might be to listen to a politician? Not that there are many politicians talking about climate change in a positive way anyway, but
made a movie. I think so. I mean, like kind of a Day After Tomorrow was a successful movie made at that time, like I think $560 million. It's like today like $1 billion. And I'm like kind of, I have to say, more and more I think, okay, nobody else does it, I will do it probably again and try to come up with something.
I think I spoke to Adam McKay and he said that his next movie will probably be about climate change and global warming and about how people are putting their fingers in their ears and not listening until it's too late.
He's a great director,
so but it is interesting because obviously that you also have the idea that, you know, these huge machines, these huge pieces of entertainment also have a fairly big carbon footprint as well. So do you think Hollywood has a responsibility to offset that in a way?
Well, I mean, it's like kind of the carbon footprint of a movie is not that big. I mean, you know, I think, for example, meat eating and cows are some of the biggest offenders. So we have to all become vegan. You know, and that would help a lot. And then the next thing is cars, you know, and there's like already a huge, you know, like trend towards electric cars, but maybe not enough and not fast enough. And then airplanes is also like kind of a huge offender. So I don't think like kind of movies are big offender in that form. maybe mainly because they're using cars and driving to drive around, but whatever. But I have the feeling the biggest problem, I think, which we will face is just a geopolitical one. Yeah. Because what I mentioned earlier, so you have like a lot of people, you know, cannot live off their land anymore.
There's going to be huge displacement.
Yes, huge and displacement. That is like kind of, yeah. I think, a movie should show that.
Absolutely. I have to say, Roland, I get all those points. I take them all on board. But going vegan for me is going to be very, very tough.
Me too. Me too. I'm not vegan yet. Just like kind of thinking about it.
How close are you?
Well, I had like a hamburger with lately, which was vegan, and it tasted like a hamburger.
See, really? Because if they do that, if they can crack that, if they can crack a vegan meal that would taste like meat and has the texture of meat.
Yeah, yeah, that is texture is like naturally easier in a hamburger, yeah, because it's hot, yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
I think they haven't figured out how to create meats artificially.
We'll check back in on the next one, the next movie, see how far along we are on the road there. So the next one is going to be Moonfall,
yep,
which is very, very exciting.
And it's just a very simple concept. It's a moon is falling to Earth, and the moon is not what we think it is.
Yes.
So it's super easy to explain, right?
So a school of thought that it's too much of a coincidence that it is exactly the right distance from the Earth to affect the tides and to affect...
Well, yeah, it's like, and then there's a lot of peculiarities about the moon, and they will all get explained.
I look forward to that one. And that sounds like a... Not necessarily a return to the likes of Independence Day, but and 2012. But
well, it's a little bit like it has a little more philosophical kind of undertones. You know, It's like really answering a lot of questions we have: where is life coming from, etc. And also, it's a little bit more it's space exploration because we have to go up there and fix it.
So it's 2012 meets 2001.
Yeah, something like that.
Which is 4013, I will take. It's like
I'll stay take. Away from numbers. There are too many movies with numbers in them anyway.
But hang on, if we then throw Moon 44 into the equation, then I don't know
exactly,
where we are.
Exactly.
Who knows? Who knows?
It's like no more numbers.
What is it with you and the moon, Roland? I mean, why are you returning?
Well, it's like kind of just, I mean, even as a kid, I was fascinated by the moon. It's like, so it's every day, it's like kind of... Especially when you live in California, we have like some moonrises which are spectacular. Mm. And then just imagine that like kind of the whole sky is a moon. Mm-hmm. It's pretty kind of cool images.
Yes. Yeah. It should be fun. Look forward to that. And how far away are you from starting?
I will like start shooting probably in April or May.
Excellent. And one of the interesting things about Midway, and in fact throughout your career, is that not all the time, but you do like to use... the same actors again and again. So it was lovely seeing Dennis Quaid and Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, also for me, cool.
Yeah, and and you seem to be someone who has, you know, you worked with Harold Closer an awful lot over the last 15 years or so as well.
Yeah.
So you clearly like working with the same people.
Yeah.
When do you know when you've clicked with someone, when you click with an actor and you want to use them again?
Well, with like kind of a Woody, it's like just, for me, I'm fascinated by him because he can be funny, he can be serious, he can be everything. Mm. And Dennis was like just perfect as Halsey, I thought, because Halsey was also like this grumpy, you know, like kind of man. And I think Dennis, even he's not grumpy as a person, but he can play very well grumpy. And it was just also like kind of a cool thing for me, you know, that like after, you know, so many years, you know, Dennis, you know, like kind of came back, you know, in a movie. And the first thing what he said to me, gosh, you know, I mean, this Day After Tomorrow, I at that time, I didn't thought it was like really, and we were right.
Yep,
I said, well,
documentary.
You know, I said like, oh, really? We were right. And Woody is just, he became a bit of a friend. I mean, when we like kind of shoot movies, we also hang out in the evening, mm-hmm. Well, that's nice. which is cool, or on the weekend.
It'd be interesting to see what you guys get up to.
Yeah, only stupid stuff, trust me.
I can imagine. And obviously, as well, Roland, you've worked with both Quaid brothers as well.
Randy, we have lost somewhat.
Randy, we have lost.
We have lost to the Canadian wilderness, I hear. He's like somewhere in a camper, somewhere in the Canadian woods. No joke.
No, absolutely. That's where he is. Yeah.
With his wife, Evie.
Yeah.
I mean, Evie, she was then already his girl.
Oh, back on
Independence Day. They were not married yet, but they were together, and I saw it coming.
It makes sense now, watching the movie.
But it's
back.
Like, kind of, then on the other hand, I kind of really liked when they made like a YouTube video where Evie with a face mask of Murdoch is like fucking him from behind. That was quite entertaining, I thought.
We've all seen it. We might as well. Let's not pretend we haven't seen it. Yeah, it was interesting.
Interesting.
It's not on his CV officially, but it's still one of the best movies.
I think it should be.
It's one of the most interesting movies he's made in the last 10 years.
Exactly.
That's for sure. On that note, an interesting note in which to end, Roland Emmerich, it's been a pleasure, as always. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Bye.
What a nice man. Okay.
Did the interview start midway?
That's terrible, James.
Yeah.
That's awful. Anyway, he's a very nice man. I like him.
I love Roland Emmerich.
Even
he's
though
brilliant.
He made Anonymous, which I still haven't quite forgiven him for. Time for some movie news. What have we got this week?
Well, the thing I guess that's happened most recently, they have announced a date for Disney Plus. Normally, yes. I would, of course, save this for the Pilot TV podcast, but sure, let's do it while it's just two of us here, Alan. So, 31st of March will be when Disney Plus launches in the UK.
Mm.
So, a full good few months after it launches, well, everywhere else, which is an interesting one. So, I think they were looking at the possibility of finding sort of syndicating partners for things like The Mandalorian. Because The Mandalorian will launch in the US, you know, this month essentially, and we will be waiting another 4 months before we see it in the UK. And presumably they've got piracy concerns about that, and I think they were going to say, you know, do we do something with Sky? For whatever reason, those deals didn't work out. So in the UK, we are banned from seeing this essentially until March, which is less than ideal.
It is not great for those of us who are crazy Star Wars fans.
Yeah, it's not great. I wonder whether they will drop them all at once in March, as opposed to rolling them out week by week, which is what they're going to do everywhere else.
Oh, interesting.
But then you've got to wonder whether they'll do that, because Disney Plus is an interesting one. So Disney Plus has got the weight of sort of legacy IP stuff. They've got all the old Disney back catalogue, but more importantly, they've got all the Marvel TV shows, they've got the Star Wars TV shows. But if you look at the rollout schedules, they're not coming for a long time. Like, I believe the first Marvel show is Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which is essentially end of next year.
And that's only just started shooting.
Yeah. So it's a long way off. So Mandalorian is their only, I think, must-watch thing. And if they drop them all on launch day, there's a sense that, are we now doing with this?
So what, you get your free month's trial and
then you're like, well, I'm done now. The Mandalorian, I've seen it. I'm finished.
I'll see you in November Winter Soldier.
And you've got to think, with the streaming wars kicking off now, they can't afford to do that.
I feel like there's going to be a lot more to it. And I also feel like they're going to have a lot more content, but maybe it's just not specifically geared to you as a nerd. And maybe it's specifically geared to kids. I mean, there's going to be a huge amount there that kids are going to be obsessed about. Frozen 2 will probably be on there
almost
by March, right?
Yeah.
So there's going to be stuff like that that they're going to have, which is going to be a pretty tasty prospect.
Where it can't, I guess, I mean, do we know if Disney Life is continuing or they're going to end Disney Life? Because I imagine if they sort of migrate people from that, you know, then that opens up a much sort of broader, sort of younger audience. But it's interesting. So Apple TV Plus obviously has launched.
That launched last week.
They had The Morning Show, they had C, they had Dickinson. They had, I thought, quite a strong lineup when they launched. I know it's had some mixed reviews. C, I am absolutely down for. I'm really enjoying this.
Yes, but it's basically your Sandra Bullock favourite redone,
right? A little bit. But it's just so much fun. And Momoa is so awesome as this kind of, like, he's basically a huge blind John Wick running around in a post-apocalyptic wilderness. And what is not to love about that idea?
I mean, that does sound great.
There is a fight sequence, a blind choreographed fight sequence in episode 3, which has to be seen to be believed. It is the most badass thing I think I've ever seen on television.
Is it a bit Zatoichi?
Oh, very much like that. You know, or Blind Justice, whatever your point of reference is, or Book of Eli. But this one in particular, it has a different texture. And I think things like Zatoichi and things like, let's not talk about Blind Justice, but things like Book of Eli, it's very much like it's traditional combat, but he happens to be blind. And in Book of Eli, spoiler, you don't even know he's blind until the end of the film. I've just ruined Book of Eli.
You have totally ruined Book of Eli.
Fair enough. But in this, like, the nature of fighting is adapted to the fact that this is a world in which no one can see. So the way they actually approach everything, especially combat, is fundamentally very tactile and very different. And I love the attention to detail. Also, it's got these demented masturbatory interludes that I can't even get my head around. So in the first episode, the queen says she has to pray, so proceeds to pleasure herself in a holy way, and then doubles down on that in every possible sense in the second episode, and you're just like, I don't understand this at all. And it's really uncomfortable watching this with the PR sitting next to me. But
what?
Yeah, don't ask.
You know what? Don't answer. I don't want to know.
But so there's loads of good stuff on Apple. But what I think it's different approaches. So Disney Plus is resting on their IPs. They've got Marvel, they've got Star Wars, they've got their back catalogue.
Pixar.
Exactly. And Apple has none of that. So what they've essentially done is they've got good people and they've said, people like Stephen Knight, and said, Have all the money and do whatever the fuck you want. Go absolutely batshit mental. Stephen Knight's going, all right, here's an idea. Everyone has to wank to pray. No, everyone's blind. It takes place in the future. And they're like, brilliant, do it. And it's just shit like that. You know, and someone's, and Hayley Steinfeld's going, oh, okay, right. So it's about Emily Dickinson. Like, yeah. So like, it's like a period by a period. No. She goes, I want it to be like a half hour teen comedy about Emily Dickinson. And I want Wiz Khalifa playing Death. Brilliant, do it. You know, that's their whole ethos. And it's amazing and it's genius. And I'm there for it.
How many of these can we commit to?
all of the shows, as much as possible.
There's only so much time and I have work to do.
Well, I've seen the M. Night Shyamalan show, which is on there, and I'm not allowed to talk about it because it's embargoed. But all I'm going to say is, without reviewing the show, watch the trailer and you will see a show that is completely mental. You know, it's really bold and it's really brave. And, you know, I can't help thinking that Martin Scorsese would very much approve of this, because it is people taking risks and pushing boundaries, and there is no safety here whatsoever.
Yes, they are they really examining the human condition? Because if they're not, I'm not interested.
Your mileage may
similar,
vary.
You know.
But I think if Martin Scorsese had to choose between Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus...
obviously that, yeah.
But I know, like, where he'd go.
There's a reason nobody's asking him to do that.
Yeah,
you
that's
know.
True. That's
it's
true.
Interesting, if people haven't read it yet, there was an op-ed by Martin Scorsese in the New York Times this week, further kind of explaining his position. It's a stunningly written piece. Obviously, he's Martin Scorsese. I agree with about 75% of it, obviously, because I'm me. But yeah, it's a bit more context for you know, his remarks, and it's definitely worth a read.
We should also mention that obviously this whole furore about Marty versus Disney kicked off with Nick DeSemlin's interview with him about The Irishman. We have put the entire unedited interview now on the website so people can see the quotes in context as part of his broader Irishman piece. So I do recommend you check it out on empireonline.com.
Absolutely. There is other news that we should talk about. I've already mentioned the James Dean thing, but let's talk about this for a minute, because it's the worst ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my entire life. The makers of a new Vietnam War drama called Finding Jack have claimed that they really searched and searched for someone to play a particular role in their film, and they decided that the best possible person for the role would be CG James Dean. And they've been talking, I believe, to his estate to get the rights to use CG James Dean instead of any living actor in a film set in an era when he was already about 20 years dead.
Where do you even begin with this? Because, first of all, this operates somehow on the premise that James Dean was better than every living actor now, which is obviously not the case.
Well, he was very good.
Yeah, of course he was. But the not reason enough to he dig was, him up.
The reason he was very good was because he was an incredibly sensitive actor. He was incredibly nuanced. He was incredibly human. And you know I love VFX. You know I'm always going to sort of stand up for VFX. They would say they're not there yet.
Yeah.
They would say they can't do that. And if they are getting, if the response to that is to get someone to give them those emotions and then they turn that into James Dean, then the response is, why not use that person who just gave you those emotions
Absolutely.
And don't turn it into James Dean? Mm. It's a utterly ludicrous thing. Now, if you were, for example, Quentin Tarantino making Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and you wanted James Dean and Marilyn Monroe in the background of a party, obviously it wouldn't be Once Upon a Time in Hollywood because they would have been dead by then. But you know what I mean?
Yes,
if they
absolutely.
If you wanted them in passing in the background of a room, CG could do that pretty damn well and it would be pretty cool. But having an actual role in your film played by a dead actor, like
when
a
they're not playing themselves,
role,
like, it's no logic to it.
This is mad.
It's no logic to it. We're in Simone territory, aren't we? Like, it's just...
If you haven't seen the Robin Wright film, The Congress, that's exactly what this is about. And you should definitely watch the Robin Wright film, The Congress, because it's fascinating. It goes to some really weird places and crazy animation and all sorts of craziness. But it is absolutely on this issue and it's really worth watching. But the takeaway here is just James Dean, don't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Did anyone use the headline Rebel Without a Corpse?
I hope not, James. I really hope not. But there it is. That's a thing that hopefully won't happen.
Yeah, that's really...
In fairness, it's a film that doesn't appear to have much other sort of, you know, above the line
virtues,
eye-catching stuff, eye-catching
things to recommend
stuff,
it.
Let's say so maybe this is just a publicity stunt, and maybe they'll back off. Let's hope. There was also news about the Batman casting continues. They are still trying to make me interested in Batman. Yeah.
Is it working?
It kind of is.
Okay.
Colin Farrell as the Penguin.
Yeah.
It's so deeply counterintuitive, isn't it? I mean, that's not what the Penguin looks like.
What's the Christmas movie where he plays Satan? Is it like Fairy Tale of New York or something? Is it called something like that?
It is called something like that, yeah.
And do you think it's going to be a bit like that? Like sinister, sinister criminal Farrell?
Look, as long as he doesn't turn into Johnny Depp in the last act,
yeah.
I am here for it. I adore him in Daredevil. I think his Bullseye is one of the great comic book villains I know.
Is he though?
Yeah, honestly, I just love him. That whole, you made me miss. Oh, I freaking love it.
Oh, God.
So I'm super here for it. But
superhero
yeah,
not, for it.
Superhero for it. Super villain for it. But it's not what I would have expected.
No. And Alfred.
And Alfred. Andy Serkis.
Yeah. That I like. I'm absolutely there for Andy Serkis. All the fun of the circus.
Yeah.
In Alfred.
I think it's a really good call. He's smart. He's sarky.
Mm.
And you need someone who can kind of puncture Bruce Wayne's ego just a little bit. And also just he has that air of capability, doesn't he? So that kind of feels like
and
somebody.
And he'll probably be really into it because he'll be scarred from having just directed Venom 2. So.
Hey.
What?
No, hey, he's going to be fine.
That, actually, weirdly, he's the only thing that makes me excited about Venom 2. So, so that's good. They're doing a Scream 5. Have you seen this?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Apparently, there is news, whether it will actually happen, but there is news that they're aiming to do another Scream film, which clearly is what we've all been crying out for.
Screaming for.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, this could be good. Scream 4 wasn't the greatest, but yeah. Scream still was, and Scream 2 was great.
I mean, Wes Craven clearly not involved, and on account of, you know, being deceased.
Yeah.
But Kevin Williamson, I don't think, is involved either.
Oh.
So this feels a little bit like a huh.
Huh.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Also, Scream is one of those things where Scream was brilliant in the era it came out because it did something new and bold. And now it's just only, like, its main hook, its main thing is no longer relevant. Like, everything is meta now.
But maybe they can find a way to make it new again.
What, by just doing a flat-out horror with no irony or self-awareness whatsoever? Like an old-school slasher flick?
Maybe.
And they're like, yep, we're original again.
Or maybe they take it through meta and out the other side, like a Fast and Furious movie.
Wow, what lies on the other side of meta, Helen?
I don't know. I spoke about Colin Farrell turning into Johnny Depp a moment ago. There was news this week that there will be a third Fantastic Beasts film, and
oh,
it is apparently
fantastic.
Moving to Brazil for its setting. So that's kind of interesting, following New York and Paris. Apparently, Jessica Williams' character, Professor Lally Hicks, who's in one of the teachers at the US version of Hogwarts, Ilvermory, will have a bigger role this time. She appeared very briefly. You might just remember in Crimes of Grindelwald.
I might not.
You might not. But she will apparently be back. And so will, of course, all of the core cast. But that's a thing that's still happening. And, you know, maybe this time the story will start. So I'm hopeful for that.
Yes.
I just want them to just get into their plot, just sink their teeth into their plot and stop going off on these side quests.
Have you heard that John Spates is writing the next Dune film, but not now the Bene Gesserit TV spin-off?
I did, and I think this is a good thing, right?
Yeah, I'm not sad about it.
Mm.
I mean, my feelings about Dune are well documented.
Are you a fan?
All the Dune, all the time. I'm very excited about this.
I'm also glad that they're kind of gearing up for the second part. I feel like that's a good sign that they're confident in what they've got for a start, which I think they probably should be.
I'm with you, and like no one loves Dune more than I do, but I'm very aware that this film, you know, I'm not saying John Carter level, but it's possible because it's so fucking dense and it's the least accessible thing in the world. And I think, you know, it's going to require an incredible feat of storytelling to pull this off. If they do, it could be the best film of the year. Mm. If not, John Carter of Mars. So,
hey, John Carter, you know, is underrated.
There'll be Jeddaks all over the place.
It's John Carter is underrated. But no, I do think this is a good thing. I think that they have a lot of story to tell, so they need to be planning this second film fairly quickly. I hope people know by this point what Dune is, because God knows we bang on about it enough, but it's a...
Well, who's got 20 minutes? I'm very happy to go through it for you.
Let me summarise what James was about to say. It's a sci-fi epic set on the desert planet Dune. The incoming noble family put in charge of it are basically facing a cunning trap left by the outgoing family in charge of it, who are all freaking psychos.
Led by the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen.
Correct.
Harkonnen.
Played here by...
a man from Geardy Prime.
Stellan Skarsgård,
yes.
Correct.
And
so our heroes, Oscar Isaac, Rebecca Ferguson, yes. And Timothy Chalamet.
As Duke Leto Atreides, the Lady Jessica Atreides, and of course Paul Atreides, a.k.a. Muad'Dib.
She's just the Lady Jessica, isn't she?
That's right, because she's a concubine. She's not actually his wife. Oh, good, you've out-June-splained me, Helen. Congratulations.
Yes.
You
victory
have
is
out-June'd
mine.
Me.
Victory
wow.
is mine. Bring That's me the true. Finest bagels and muffins in all the land.
You have one dune.
Anyway, the point is, it's a big clash. There's going to be some problems. Everything
and worms.
Is awesome.
Lots of worms. Lots of spice.
Giant
very spicy.
Worms. Yes.
Giant worms.
Think Tremors.
Yeah.
Meets Tatooine.
Yes.
It's going to be great.
That's probably how they pitched it.
I hope so.
Speaking of things that were a raging success, Terminator Dark Fate debuted in the cinema.
I liked it.
And Helen went to see it. Unfortunately, no one else did. This is a film that debuted to $29 million at the US box office.
That's not terrible.
Which means it may well lose $100 million.
Okay, that's terrible.
So it's possible that short of them sending a cyborg back in time to stop Tim Miller from making this film, this may be it for Terminators forever. It's terminated.
Look, I mean...
Like a little thumb disappearing into the lava.
Okay. You know I'm kind of conflicted here because on one hand, I really enjoyed this film and I'm actually intrigued by these characters and would watch more. On the other hand, I'm sick of us recycling all the same old franchises and I think sometimes they should be allowed to die in the lava. Well, molten metal.
Yes.
So I'm conflicted. I'm torn. I'm kind of okay if they don't make any forever or certainly a few decades. But on the other hand, I genuinely like this film and I know people have been like, oh, what the fuck, Helen? Oh. It's political correctness gone mad. You just like it because it's girls. And no, I genuinely liked it because it was, I think, probably Linda Hamilton. That's not the point. I thought it was really good.
Yeah,
so,
I know you did.
I know.
No, look, I didn't hate it. I was on set of this film. You know, like, I've been quite, you know, involved. Like, you know, I wasn't involved in the production, but I was immersed in it for a while at least. And I thought the leads were all great. I thought it had lots of personality. I don't think it did anything badly. It just felt like a now compilation, you know, like a greatest hits thing. It's like all of this has been done before and better. And that doesn't make it a bad film, but it doesn't make it a great film. That said, I would hate to be a person trying to follow Terminator 2, which is a stone cold classic movie. Yeah. And I don't know how...
Well, nobody ever has managed it.
No, exactly.
So.
Like, it's an incredible piece of filmmaking and I just... Yeah, this was never going to measure up to that. But, I mean, there will be no Terminator slightly darker fate because, frankly, they're going to be paying this off for a while.
Well, maybe that'll be a podcast. You know, if we're doing... I'm doing a podcast called His Darker Materials to tie in with His Dark Materials. So maybe there's a podcast somewhere called Terminator Darker Fate. To tie in with this.
It's just Tim Miller explaining why no one would see the film.
I do think it's a shame, but hey, so it goes. I was pleased this week. Now, I know Chris isn't here to talk about how much he loves The Equalizer. So I'm going to say...
Go on.
I didn't love it. It was fine.
It's fine.
But Queen Latifah is apparently going to be starring in a TV remake
of The Equalizer.
And I'm kind of here for that.
The Equalizer.
Yeah, because I think Queen Latifah is freaking great. I watched voluntarily, for enjoyment, Last Holiday again this week. Because you know what? I think it's underrated. I think she's super charming in it. And I think she can be great in the right roles. So I am here for it. She's going to be starring in and co-producing the new series. And she'll be the retired intelligence operative who rights wrongs and
will she start
and so on.
The stopwatch on her watch before she goes and kills loads of people? Do you think she'll do that?
I hope so. I don't know.
We'll find out.
But yeah, this is good news for me. I'm a fan, so this could be interesting.
Okay.
What else have we got? There were a few trailers that are worth watching. The new Pixar film Soul has a trailer that's out. It's about, you'll never guess, souls. It's by, you won't guess, Pete Docter.
Yeah.
Who's the one who does all the metaphysical stuff.
I've seen loads of this.
Have you?
Yes, because they did a big Soul presentation at D23. I have got Soul. And I'm not a soldier. But yeah, no, it looked really fun. It looks mental. Like where souls go, and I wonder how much of it I'm supposed to be saying. But so there's you know, obviously it's a character who falls down a manhole and dies and ends up in the afterlife. But it's a melding of like spirituality, of, you know, the sort of existentialism, visions of the afterlife, and jazz. And this is the key part of this, and jazz.
And it's for kids.
So kids, if you're really into smooth jazz, existentialism and spirituality, this film is your bag.
I feel like Tim Robbins in the Hudsucker Proxy is like holding up a circle and going, you know, for kids. It's just,
yeah, that's what it is.
It makes no sense.
But Pixar have done this before. I mean, if you look at what Inside Out essentially is, like, well, it's a metaphysical look at emotions and how they shape the psyche and how our past really, really defines our future. And you're like, and it's for kids. Sure.
That is an incredible piece of filmmaking, and I know I've said this before, but it's an incredible piece of filmmaking because it's two completely different films happening on the same screen at the same time. Adults are watching a totally different movie to the one kids are seeing, and it's just so clever. So if he can do that again, I will just bow down and all.
Pixar are incredible. Amazing. Like what they did with Toy Story 4, where adults were watching a quite tedious and unnecessary sequel to a load of films that were once good, and then kids were watching, oh no, that's right, it was the same thing.
Hey, some people like that movie a lot.
Kaboom.
Anyway, also in the trailer news, the new one from Ben Zeitlin's Beast of the Southern Wild filmmaker, his new film Wendy had a trailer this week, which is definitely worth watching. And the other one that really took me by surprise was Nicolas Cage in the trailer for The Color Out of Space, which is about a color that comes from space. I can't stress that enough. And it looks amazing. And I can't wait to see it.
What color is it?
It's kind of a purpley pink, but he says it's not quite that. You can't describe it. So... it's pretty great.
Wow.
It genuinely looks good.
This is like the visual equivalent of umami, isn't it? Where it's just on the tip of your tongue. You can't quite describe what it is.
Do you know what colour it is?
What?
It's octarine.
Oh, this is Discworld, isn't it?
Is.
Yes.
The colour of magic.
Or, Helen, could it be Parol? See, that's a very niche reference to Brent Week's Black Prism fantasy series.
That was a niche reference. So niche, in fact, that I don't get it and don't tend to find out.
Fair enough.
Okay, I think that's probably enough news.
Yeah.
I hope.
I think we've exhausted it. On to the films I haven't seen.
Yeah, something massive will no doubt happen in about an hour and a half, but for now... Yeah.
Martin Scorsese has announced as the director of Avengers, the next 6, 7, and 8.
Avengers Unending Game. That would be brilliant. Speaking of Martin Scorsese... our next interview, Stephen Graham, has been acting since he was in his teens and he broke through in Guy Ritchie's Snatch. Now he's playing mobster Provenzano in Martin Scorsese's The Irishman and he wears the most amazing shorts you've ever seen in it. It's a reunion for the pair after their long collaboration on Boardwalk Empire. So we sent Nick around to find out more about his experience following in Leo and Bob's footsteps as Marty's muse.
We are very, very excited to have Mr. Stephen Graham on the Empire podcast. Hello, sir.
Hello, mate.
Last time we chatted on the phone earlier this year, you'd just accidentally dropped your phone into a pond.
Yeah, I remember that now.
How is the new one working out?
It's all right. Yeah, it's still the same. I got the same size. It's the same diddy one. But my kids do nothing but take the... take the Michael out of me.
You can swear. You can say anything.
Take the piss out of me all the time, Grace and Alfie, because look at your little phone. But I don't want one of them big house bricks in my pocket. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah, I dropped it in. As I was going in the gym, there's like a little bridge across this like tiny pond thing with lots of carp in it.
Have you dropped anything else in that?
No,
pond?
That's the only thing I've ever dropped in there.
It's not
what
full
a
of your...
thing to drop.
Well, I'm glad the new one is still in your pocket. So, yeah, we're here to talk about The Irishman, which is just about to come out on the big screen, and then it's going to hit Netflix later in November. Yeah. So you play Tony Pro.
Yeah.
Tony great character Pro name, great character. You got offered that role at Martin Scorsese's house.
Yes. There's more of a backstory to it in the respect of, you know, I was filming with Shane, we were doing The Virtues, and I got a call on a Wednesday saying, you know, I had to be in New York on Saturday morning to sit down with Marty, because Marty was doing this great big film and, you know, had a great cast in it. I didn't know much about it, to be completely honest. But I had to fly out to meet Robert De Niro because he was exec producer and he wanted to sign off on it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, as you can
imagine.
Bit of
pressure.
Yeah, a little bit of pressure, as you can imagine. And flew out there and, you know, it was all great and met Marty at his house and Mr. De Niro comes about 20 minutes later and comes in and he's got a little paper under his arm and that little cap on, pair of shorts, and he's just like, hey, hello, I'm Bob. And I was like, hello. All right. And then we just chatted. We got to talk and he asked me, you know, about why I wanted to be an actor, where I grew up, what it was like, where I come from, you know, my family and my background and stuff like that. And we just really started chatting and it was lovely. And all of a sudden, the next minute, Ellen Lewis, who's the wonderful casting director, popped her head around the corner at the door and just said, Stephen needs to get a plane. We've been in there for 2 hours, do you know what I mean? And it was like, oh, okay. And then I went, so have I got it? And he was like, just give us a few more minutes. Just go and wait downstairs. And so my bottle was gone still, do you know what I mean? I wasn't quite sure. And then I've come back up and he's gone, I'll let Marty tell you. So then I'm still thinking, oh, no. why he just doesn't quite like me, or he just doesn't quite think I'm right. Or, and then he went, Marty went, right, okay, so, well, do you want to do this, kid? And I was like, yeah, of course I do, yeah. And then Mr. De Niro give me a little cuddle and just kind of said, you know, nice, you're going to be great, you're going to be great, kid. And that was it. I felt like I was a made man, do you know what I mean?
Oh, I love that you were the one in that scenario having to leave early.
Yeah, I know, isn't that great? But, I mean, you know, you have to understand, as a kid, I can't remember if I was 14 or I was 15, and I said to my dad, I said, I think I really want to give this acting a go. Do you know what I mean? It's something I really love doing, and I feel passionate about it. And he's like, are you sure? And I went, yeah, I really think I do, Dad. I think this is what I want to do. And he went, okay, come ahead. And we left the flat, and we went to Quarry Green Video Shop, which was, I'm talking in the days of when we were kids, do you know what I mean, when there was videos. And we went, and I'm in the video shop. And I used to love going to video shop anyway, do you know what I mean? Because he was just brilliant. And I wasn't there getting Porky's or something like that, I remember. And he's just picked these three films out, and he's gone, right, this one, The Deer Hunter. This one, Taxi Driver. And he's gone on this one here, The Godfather. And he went, come on, let's go and watch these. And we spent the weekend watching them films. I think we watched them all twice as well.
That's a heavy weekend.
It was a heavy weekend. But I just remember, like, just being engrossed in these films and just these characters and this world. And I think that's where my love for that whole kind of beautiful classic American film started, you know what I mean? And he just turned to me at the end of it and he went, oh, look, I'm not saying you never will, but, you know, that's acting. That's proper movie making. And I was like, yeah, it is, isn't it, Dad? So you can imagine when I came out of that room I phoned the missus first, I phoned Annie, and the next person I phoned is my dad. Do you know what I mean? And the joy in the sound on his voice when I went, Dad, you never guess what.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was really beautiful, do you know what I mean?
And so I guess it's probably fair to say Robert De Niro is one of your heroes.
Of course.
And you're suddenly getting a cuddle from him.
Yeah.
What's a Robert De Niro cuddle like?
Yeah, it was lovely. It was just a nice normal cuddle. It was a nice little cuddle, yeah. It was very soft and gentle. Yeah, it was really lovely.
And it's the meeting of the two Al Capones as well, which is...
Well,
really
that's fun. That was one of the things as well while we're sitting there and we're chatting and stuff. And Marty went to, you know, you two have got something in common. You both played Al Capone. And I was like... and he looked at me and he went, yeah, you were great. You were really good. You were great. And I was like, oh my God, I can't quite believe it. That's just, you know, as a young lad growing up, and like I've explained to you, you know, that's where my passion came from to be an actor. You never in your wildest dreams imagine, for one, you're going to meet these people. Because, you know, even if you want to be an actor and, you know, that's what I want to do. And, you know, my head was always, let's hope I'll be able to do enough to be able to make a living out of it. You know what I mean? I never had these illusions of grandeur and I never wanted to be famous or nothing like that. That was not what I was in it for. It's not, never what I have been in it for. It was just for the passion and the love of the craft and the art of it. But you know, and you know, your head flies off into little Willy Wonka factory kind of fantasies occasionally, do you know what I mean? But you never ever think that you're going to meet these people, let alone be sat across a table having a conversation, then let alone be turning up on set with them to actually act. It's just beyond the comprehension, do you know what I mean? So for me to be in that position in that situation, it was mind-blowing, it really was. But it was beautiful because the three of them, you know, I spent a good little bit of time with Joe and Joe was wonderful. I didn't spend much time filming with him, but we talked quite a bit and I had some food with him and I, you know, he had his chef with him and he made me some food and stuff like
that.
Does
he have his own chef?
That's awesome. He did. I mean, you know, he can. And it was just really lovely and he's a really wonderful sweet man, but the other two I got to spend a lot more time with and to actually work with them, do you know what I mean? And what I found with all of them right across the board, Marty, obviously I've got a relationship with Marty, but what I found right across the board was there was no egos at all, not even a hint, do you know what I mean? Not even a hint of any kind of ego. They treated everyone with respect on the set. Everyone, the sound man, the props designer, the costume designers, they treated everybody on the set with exactly the same. And I just found that a beautiful quality from two wonderful, amazing actors who were also really beautiful, humble men, do you know what I mean? They're my heroes. And people say you should never meet your heroes. But in this case, that wasn't what happened. Yeah. It was just amazing.
You get to antagonise your heroes as well in this film because, I mean, talking of ego, one person who does have an ego is Tony Pro, your character.
Giant ego.
So entertaining. And this scene has gone up online recently of you turning up late to a meeting with Jimmy Hoffa, played by Al Pacino. And it is such a great scene. You're wearing what can only be described as power shorts.
Yes, shorts and shirt combo.
It's an amazing set piece. Like, talk us through preparing for that and what was that like? It must have been electric.
Yeah, it was. You know, that was actually my final day, that scene. That was my last day of shooting, and we'd shot all the other stuff and it had all gone brilliant. And it was just such a great scene anyway on paper. And I'd already kind of developed this character and, you know, I'd done a lot of research. I'd watched some documentaries. So I felt comfortable now with the character completely. Do you know what I mean? And I'd kind of, with the stuff I'd seen, this footage of Tony Pro at a rally when he's re-elected for the Teamsters. And Marty literally shot that shot for shot in the piece that we see. So I had a basis for his accent and everything. And I had a good solid understanding of it. And Sandy Powell, our magnificent costume designer, she found these great shirt and shorts combos.
So it's all pineapples on it.
It's pineapples on it. It's amazing. I've actually got one.
Amazing. You get it.
Yeah, she gave me one. She gave me one and I've got it in our wardrobe at home because it's just so brilliant. And it was that, you know, because he was a very flamboyant, gregarious man. He did photo shoots with magazines.
He gets his own theme tune in the film. I think you get a little Tony Pro song.
Tony Pro. You've
got to make that your ringtone.
But this was all from the footage, do you know what I mean? That had happened at that rally. But also a lot of the research I'd done on him, he was a very gregarious character. He was very flamboyant and he liked his colours and his clothes. He was making a statement practically all the time, do you know what I mean? And he wasn't this kind of hideaway gangster. He was like, look at me, this is what I'm doing, do you know what I mean? This is how I'm living. And to hell with the rest, he's more or less, do you know what I mean? So that scene, we get into it and we're starting to do it a little bit and it's getting a bit freer and stuff. And it's all that kind of 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and Marty went to me, you know, but on about the fifth or sixth take, I'm in it, and I look across, and Robert De Niro's across from me, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm in a scene with Robert. For a split second, my head went, I'm in a scene with Robert De Niro, and he doesn't say anything. Shit. Dust off. And then he went, right, play with it now. And I went, can I play with it? He went, yeah, play with it. Come on. I've really lifted up now. And I was like, okay. So then we're doing it again. He's doing a 10, 15. And then I just turned and I just looked at him and I just went, what do you think, Frank? And he just looked at me and there's this little smile because he's laughing at the argument between the two of them. And he just goes, 12 and a half. And to me, that's my favorite line of that scene. You know what I mean? And that was a little improvised moment. And then I get to go up and walk off because I think, oh, I've had enough of this. And then it was like, no, sit down. Come on, sit down. And it was that. That's what I'm saying, because they're such generous actors. They made me feel comfortable to be able to really play with it, you know what I mean? And it was like, well, come on then, bring, you know, you lead the scene for a little bit and we'll swap it around between us, you know what I mean? And it was that, and it's that. That's what Marty does. He gives you that confidence, exactly the same as Shane Meadows. He gives you that confidence to be able to play, and there's no right and there's no wrong, do you know what I mean? You find the scene and the truth within the scene as a collective. So there's no egos at all on a set like that.
One of my favourite things about The Irishman is you've got these incredibly powerful guys arguing sometimes about really silly, small, petty things. Yeah. And in this case, you guys are arguing about how late you can be to meet someone and for it to be okay. So what is... The opinions differ in the scene. As you, what's your definitive answer? How late can you be to meet someone and it's still all right?
I agree, traffic. Do you know what I mean? You have to take traffic into account. You have to take a lot of things into account. I don't think anyone intentionally means to turn up late. It's, you know, there's a bit of shifting.
You're quite lenient then. You're like, half an hour.
Yeah, as long as you call me. Yeah, if you tell me you're going to be half an hour, then that's sound.
Okay. And you are at the tail end of a pretty incredible year. You've had a lot of stuff coming out. The Virtues, you were amazing in Line of Duty. You're in Rocket Man, which has made a lot of money.
It was a great bit of fun.
Irishman, and now you've got a Christmas Carol coming out as well.
So. Yeah.
You've done a lot. You've had a packed.
It looks like I'm not giving anyone else a chance, doesn't it? But it's a case of these things were filmed a long time ago. Do you know what I mean? Most of them. I think The Irishman was maybe 2 years ago. So it's during that time period. It's not like I did one and one and one and one. It just so happens sometimes that that's how they kind of dropped, you know what I mean? That's the release dates of them all. Because the Virtues, we did that 2 years ago. Well, no, over 2 years ago, do you know what I mean? Because I went from the Virtues, then I had a little bit of time, and then I went to the Irishman. So it's, yeah, it's been, you know, I feel really blessed and really honoured to be able to do what I do. But you're right, yeah, right now, you know, I'm kind of riding my wave.
Feels special, like a special time.
Yeah, it really does. It feels like all that hard work and all that dedication and all that support I've had from my mother and my father and my family, do you know what I mean? All my aunties and my uncles and my friends. And there was one point, you know, a good while ago, me and I were counting the pennies for beans on toast, you know what I mean? So it's that hard work and that dedication and that, I suppose, somewhere inside that little belief that, you know, to keep striving and keep going. And without my support network that I've had around me, I'd be nowhere, do you know what I mean? I can't do this on my own. Mm. It's impossible. I know that, you know what I mean? And I've never took that in any way, but just the support network that's allowed me to be able to flourish and do what I love to do is to me, it's, you know, there's no words for it, really.
It's great. And it's worked out. Also exciting is Greyhound next year, which Tom Hanks wrote as well as appears in, which is really interesting. He doesn't write many scripts.
No.
So what can you say about that? Like, is that a personal thing for him?
Yeah, it was. He's got a huge passion for that period and also the war, do you know what I mean? Both First and Second World War, it's kind of like his little thing, do you know what I mean? And it was just a really great script, a really fantastic script based on a book, The Good Shepherd, not the film by De Niro, but this was based on a book, The Good Shepherd, about this convoy that goes across and it's taking goods to the Allies and they come under attack from the submarines, from the German submarines. And it's just this man, it's his first time he's ever been out on a ship. It's the first time he's been the captain of a ship and it's the pressure that he feels and how he copes with it and how he deals with it, you know what I mean, under this immense pressure. It was brilliant to do. And again, you know, it was such an honour to work with Tom because he really is a wonderful man, do you know? And that's it, you know, all these people who are huge stars and if you want, for a better phrase or whatever, you know, these huge stars, but again, no ego. He's treated everyone exactly the same. No, knew everyone's name, which is very pleasant and really lovely. And that's, I kind of, you know, you learn a lot from people like that. And I really admire them kind of qualities, you know what I mean? Within a human being, not as an actor, but just as a human being. He's so funny as well. He's so funny on set, you know what I mean? And he's great. And then when it comes to the work, bang, he just switches on. He's right in there.
You got a Robert De Niro cuddle. Did you also get a Tom Hanks cuddle at some point?
Yeah, I got a massive Tom Hanks
cuddle. You're collecting them.
No, I've got a really good picture, actually, where he's giving me a big sloppy kiss on the cheek. But again, you see, what was really lovely about that as well, and I'm sure I can say this now, I'm sure no one would mind, I put myself on tape, and I think the studio kind of turned around and went, well, we want a name, do you know what I mean? And he was like, I want him. I want him to play. Which, when you know you've got someone like that who's gone to bat for you, it's a bit big, do you know what I mean? And when you turn up on set, you're like, I am banged. And he's like, oh, hey, buddy. And he used to, because he heard me on the phone quite a bit to my missus and my kids, because I'd FaceTimed them when I'd be in a makeup chair because of the time difference and stuff like that. And he, because I say I love you loads, and he'd do a really, not so brilliant, but an all right impression, a COD impression, and he'd be sitting on the end of the chain, he'd go, love you loads. And it was just wonderful.
And just finally, we were chatting just before this about Christmas Carol, this new adaptation of Stephen Knight's behind it. It's got a great cast. What can we expect from you in that? And will you wear shorts in that one as well?
No, I don't wear shorts, but I wear a lot of chains. it's great. It's a fantastic script and it's a wonderful director, Nick Murphy, who I've worked with a few times now. Do you know what I mean? It's a really great piece. Guy Pearce is amazing. What a wonderfully talented actor. And it's really dark. It sticks kind of more to the novel. And there's also some added bits that Stephen and Nick came up with. And Tom Hardy is exec producer, do you know what I mean? And Tom had a major input into the development of the story and the characters and everything. And Andy Serkis is mesmerising, isn't he? I think it could be something quite special, if I'm honest, you know what I mean? And it's a joy and an honour to be a part of it. And especially to be in a classic like this, do you know what I mean? And not have to speak with a plum in my mouth. Because you don't have to all the time, do you know what I mean? there's real people out there as well. So for me to be able to be a part of something like that was a wonderful experience. And I play Jacob Marley, so it's kind of, he's a little bit, my interpretation, what I was going for was a little bit of a twisted Clarence from It's a Wonderful Life.
All right.
So it's Clarence, but it's just a little bit darker than Clarence, do you know what I mean?
Looking forward to it. I can't wait to see you rattling some chains.
Yeah, I'll rattle a good chain.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
All right, it's time for reviews, so let's start with The Irishman. So Robert De Niro plays Frank Sheehan, who's brought in to work for the mafia as a young man and soon becomes a fixer of all sorts of problems, and indeed people, for them, whether that's icing opponents for Joe Pesci's Russell Bufalino or protecting mob associate Jimmy Hoffa, who's played by Al Pacino. Now, obviously, it's a shame that Martin Scorsese couldn't get a better cast together. But apart from that, what did we think of The Irishman? Nick has just joined us. Hello, Nick.
Hello, guys. Ray Romano. Don't forget Ray Romano. He's great in this.
He is great in this. Yes, he plays a lawyer for Frank, who we meet fairly early on.
Yeah. I mean, this cast is amazing. Stephen Graham is terrific, as well as Tony Pro, who's kind of the film's Pesci from Goodfellas. But yeah, it's all about Pacino, De Niro, and Pesci. It's a great film. I really liked it. It's 3.5 hours long. You probably know that by now. You need to like block out a day to watch it. But it's great. It's Scorsese doing another gangster movie, but a very different kind of one. It's melancholy, and it's this old character looking back at his life. It'll make you feel pretty sad. But it's terrific. It's got energy, and then it really slows down in the second half.
Where do you land on the de-aging? Is it convincing?
I would say there's two scenes near the beginning where, I mean, it's a lot of de-aging because we start in 1950. So, you know, you've got Robert De Niro brought back to, you know, really sort of just out of the army, just fought in World War II. And in fact, there's one flashback to World War II that you've maybe seen, which does look a little bit Call of Duty.
The screenshots look a bit Welcome to Marwan.
Yeah, those two scenes, and it's literally two scenes, those are a little bit, whoa, they've done some CG work on him. Everything else in the film, though, I thought was pretty great, I have to say.
And how prevalent is the de-aging?
There's a lot of it. I mean, Pacino is de-aged in every single scene that
really?
He's in. Yeah,
because, or aged up in a couple, right?
De Niro is aged up. Pacino is not, because Hoffa kind of disappears. Spoiler.
Well, I mean, I think famously.
Famously disappeared. I didn't write about that in my feature because I wasn't sure if it was a spoiler or not, but yes. But yeah, De Niro, I mean, the World War II stuff is much more prevalent in the book, I Heard You Paint Houses, that it's based on, so they've used very little of that. And in the movie, it's such a quick little scene.
Yeah.
It doesn't really...
No, it doesn't.
But what's weird is he doesn't look like De Niro did at those ages. He looks like a different character.
Like a de-aged version of current De Niro as opposed to young De Niro.
Yeah. So he's more kind of hulking and a bit more fuggish. But it kind of works, I think. Mm. And especially because the whole movie is kind of done as a kind of flashback, this guy looking back.
Yeah.
I think it works really nicely.
The one thing I find a little bit off-putting at first, and I'm looking forward to seeing this again to sort of see if I settle into it, is that there's almost two framing devices here. You've got very old De Niro looking back over his life and sort of talking about it to an unnamed person, unseen person in some way. And then you also have this flashback where he's on a car journey with Pesci's character in their later lives, but not quite as late on. Mm. And there's almost a double layer of flashing back, which I find a little bit... It was easy to follow. I could tell which bits I was in at any one point. I think in that sense, it's a brilliantly made film. You always know where you are, even though it hops around through time. But I was a bit like, I don't quite get the rationale for this. And I think I only got it at the very end because the film went to a place which I thought was really powerful and really interesting and much more silent Scorsese than Goodfellas Scorsese, if you like.
Absolutely.
But maybe it's only in retrospect that that's worked. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing it again, because I did find that quite off-putting at first, but I think it might work brilliantly when I watch again.
Yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but the last hour kind of, it's really interesting. It's jumping around like Casino and Goodfellas a lot in the first half, and then that final hour really slows down, and it's not real time, but it's kind of over a day.
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly moving kind of piece of cinema. And it really boils down to Pacino and De Niro's characters and the relationship between those two guys. Yeah. And it's actually quite an intimate story, even though it's a huge epic on some levels.
Yeah.
It's about these two characters, and it really kind of hit me hard. Like, it's really kind of moving and melancholy.
Yeah, it very much is. And I think that the relationship between Pesci and De Niro's characters as well is really interesting. It's almost a father-son relationship with Pesci as the sort of the wise old mentor, but more wise guy old mentor than, you know, perhaps an entirely positive influence. So thank you. Quite proud of that. It's just fascinating relationships between the two. And again, you have, as you said, Ray Romano in there. You have Harvey Keitel, almost blink as you'll miss him, and you'll miss him in there. Stephen Graham showing up in a fabulous pair of shorts, as I mentioned.
Power shorts. We discussed those shorts. They are the best shorts of the year on the screen.
They are pretty great.
Yeah, he's terrific. It's interesting because Pesci is doing something completely the opposite of what he has done with Scorsese before, where he's this very quiet, internal, kind of simmering guy and just really good at conveying the power of this character.
Yeah.
And he's kind of scary, but yeah, there's great stuff with De Niro's daughter as well.
Yes.
And the fact that she doesn't kind of warm to either her father or to Pesci's character. Yeah. And but loves Hoffa.
She loves Hoffa a lot more. She's played by Lucy Galena, I think, as a young girl, and then obviously by Anna Paquin in adulthood. I mean, let's be honest, I'm just going to say this. The women's roles in this film are just not, with the exception of really Lucy's version of Peggy. They're there as reactors. They're there as judges almost in the background. They're not characters particularly in their own right. But I've just said it. There we go. We'll move on. It's a man's story. He's telling a man's story. That's what it is.
And I think there's a real point to it as well, though.
There is a point.
I think this guy's life is kind of bereft of love and warmth. Mm. And he's made choices that, you know, really hurt him later on. And one of them is that he just doesn't let any of that intimacy into his life. So he keeps all the women in his life at a real remove. So you're right. They're not great roles. Mm. But I think that's kind of almost deliberate. And
But it is women as a symbol. But that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I get what he's going for, and he's Martin Scorsese, so he kind of gets a pass, so fine.
But it's not cinema, Helen.
Is it cinema, though, if you've got too many women in it? You know?
Is it cinema if it's on Netflix? I don't know. Anyway.
Anyway, let's not have that debate.
You've sold me. I'm hopefully going to go and see this tonight, because I have egregiously not.
That is appalling.
Tonight into tomorrow morning.
Yes. I will be seeing it over the weekend, literally across the whole weekend.
Yes, it is 209 minutes, but it does earn those minutes in a way that other films perhaps do not. So, five stars, unsurprisingly, for Scorsese's The Irishman. So next we have Driven, which sees Jason Sudeikis play a petty smuggler, Jim Hoffman, who is caught by the FBI and put in witness protection, Ellen, who's played by Judy Greer, and they find themselves living across the road from John DeLorean, the legendary car executive and designer, who's played by Lee Pace. He's about to launch the DeLorean car company. He has big, big plans. But their lives collide, let's say, in a way that proves rather disastrous.
Helen.
Yes.
So at what point in the film do they go back in time?
Well, sadly, it's not that kind of DeLorean, so they haven't actually put on the flux capacitor yet. But that's one of the issues in the film is DeLorean's ideas for this car and how they get changed and kind of watered down, how it compromises his vision a little bit. But it's more about the lengths that he goes to, kind of egged on by Jason Sudeikis's character, in order to get the funding he needs to make his car a reality and in order to launch this new company. Because he's been... So if you don't know much about John DeLorean, I highly recommend reading up about him, because he is a fascinating, weird character. He designed some of the most successful cars ever for like Ford.
Did he?
And he was an incredibly successful car designer and executive at two of the big American car companies. I think it was Ford and Chrysler. And then he went out on his own to develop his own self-titled company, and he held all these grand schemes for how the DeLorean was going to be extraordinary and amazing. And then didn't quite work out. I don't think that's a spoiler.
I mean, he was like, I want to do a car. It's going to be a family car, but the doors are going to be like wings.
I mean, yeah, not a million miles, you know.
But you just can't take it over 88 miles an hour. Otherwise, obviously, that could cause
temporal
problems.
Yeah. But no, it's really good performances in this. If you do know much about the history, maybe you won't be as surprised as I was at the way this story goes. Because I was taken aback at the places this story goes. And then I looked them up and most of them are absolutely true. Which is quite stunning
this
stuff.
This is a stranger than fiction type scenario.
It kind of is a stranger than fiction type scenario. Now, when we get to next week, we're going to be talking about Le Mans 66
yes,
as well.
Which I saw last night.
Okay.
Because I watched a film.
That's one, James. That's well done. But it is a really interesting time for car movies, because both of these films are about cars, but they're not, you know, boring driving movies.
And car designers. And there's lots of the sort of the industry, like car-ness.
Yeah. And it's weird because I almost feel like it's a way of saying goodbye to America's obsession with cars, because they have to grow past that in the near future. So it's kind of a fascinating little bit of history. But yeah, really good performance from Lee Pace as DeLorean in particular. And then this really bizarrely pleasant blank performance from Jason Statham. And I don't mean that as a criticism, because I think that's exactly what he's going for. But his character is the kind of chancer who isn't a fast talker. He's not going to dazzle you with wit. He just sort of sits there and smiles at you and encourages your worst instincts until you kind of do something that helps him. And he does lie with absolute facility and impunity, but he doesn't bluster at you. He just sort of sits there and smiles like an idiot. And then you kind of underestimate him, and he kind of takes you on from there. It also has Corey Stoll in a succession of wigs.
To learn not to put wigs on Corey Stoll.
His bald head is so good.
It's like, why would you never put a wig on Patrick Stewart?
No,
put one on you. Well, yes, they did, but they shouldn't. But like Corey Stoll, like when he was in The Strain, it's like, what are you doing to this famously bald man?
He's such a handsome bald man, so like he just doesn't need it. Anyway, so he's in it as well. It's a really good cast, and it's getting a very, very limited release. But if it is on near you, I do recommend checking it out. And Driven got 3 stars, so that is a recommendation. Also out this week is Midway, of course, which to our shame, neither of us have seen. So we thought we'd call Chris and bring him in on this. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. You're live, except not, on the Empire Podcast.
Fucking hell. I mean, sorry. Hello.
Hello. Can you tell us about Midway, please?
Midway, yes, Helen. I am absolutely delighted to tell you about Midway. I feel a little bit bad because, obviously, I had a good time talking to Roland Emmerich. I don't want to say anything bad about his film, but what I will say about Midway is that...
I'm sorry, Chris, we're losing you,
I'm in a tunnel, going to a tunnel, Helen.
Chris, didn't you say you were at home this morning, Chris?
There's definitely a tunnel here, and hang on. And that's what I think of Midway.
I'm so glad we called you for this review, Chris. That's been enormously helpful.
Always happy to... Oh, tunnel again. Tunnel.
Hello? Hello? Well, that
Wow. We lost Chris. Midway, that call. So, Helen...
It's not very good.
Thanks, Chris. Bye.
It's not very good. There's some shooty, shooty plane bits. It takes place in the Pacific. And... That's it.
That's it. I think that's all you need to know there.
What did we give it?
About
2 stars?
So we gave that 2 stars.
Wow.
And then the other film that we brought Nick down to talk about, because to my shame I haven't seen it yet, is The Good Liar, which stars the pretty toothsome pairing of Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen. What can you tell us about this?
You kind of can't go wrong with those two, making a film about conning. This is one of those movies that's quite hard to talk about plot-wise because it is just twist after twist. It's kind of based on a bit of an airport thriller novel, and it's got some truly ludicrous twists in it. I enjoyed it. We gave it 3 stars, and I'm in the 3-star camp.
Okay.
It's very silly. Ian McKellen is kind of delightful as this very dastardly, dodgy guy who is tricking. You know, it's revealed pretty early on that he's conning people for money, and his latest mark is the character played by Helen Mirren.
Betty, isn't it?
Betty McLeish. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really stuck in my mind from watching this film is they go on a date to watch Inglourious Basterds. I don't know why, but I enjoyed that. One of my reservations about this film is that Helen Mirren doesn't really get much to do because she's kind of the mark.
Right.
And you know, because it's Helen Mirren, you know that there's going to be more to it.
You kind of want her to, yeah.
So you're kind of sitting there waiting for her to get some stuff to do. And she does, but it takes a while to get there.
Okay.
I also enjoyed Carson from Downton Abbey.
Oh, right.
Yes, Mr. Carson.
Jim Carter.
Jim
Carter of Mars.
I've been watching a lot of Downton Abbey recently, and it was delightful to watch him. He's kind of Ian McKellen's con man partner.
Amazing.
And it was just, I could watch many films about those two.
Yeah.
Getting up to schemes. So yeah, a bit silly, a bit sort of disposable, but it's just really fun watching these actors.
And Russell Tovey as well. He plays her grandson, is that right?
Right. And he's suspicious of McKellen, as one should be.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks extremely suspicious in this film, so... There we go. But yeah, 3 stars.
So 3 stars then for The Good Liar. So not a bad week for film there. 2 3-star movies. Sadly, a 2-star for Midway. But of course, 5 stars for Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. And if you act quick, you can see it on the big screen before it debuts on Netflix in a couple of weeks.
It's not showing everywhere. It's only select cinemas, but they are scattered around the place. You can find it.
So a pretty good week then for movies in the cinema.
Indeed it is.
It is cinema.
It is cinema. It is literally cinema.
Thank goodness for that.
Scorsese approves.
Are we going now? Are we nearly done?
I think we're nearly done. Yeah.
Well, before we go and taking advantage of the fact that, I don't know, Chris isn't here, I'd like to mention the Pilot TV podcast. And on this week's show, Helen, on this week's show, we are tackling the BBC's The War of the Worlds. Definite article there being quite important.
I'm excited.
Yeah. That's loads of fun. We are tackling Gold Digger, the new show with Ben Barnes and Julia Ormond. The Man in the High Castle, final season.
Ooh.
We're reviewing that as well. And of course, The Crown.
No.
We're getting down with her, Madge. Olivia Colman, of course, in the role.
Getting down with her, Madge.
Yeah, that's the kind of vernacular irreverence you can expect from the Pilot TV podcast. It should be a lot of fun. We spoke to Alfre Woodard and Jason Momoa last week about masturbatory prayer interludes. So that was special and worth listening to.
Thanks for bringing that one back.
Excellent. But one thing I should mention, a lot of people, like when we did our podcast tour, when we went round the nation, Helen, do you remember when we went out and we met our listeners and loved them all? A few of the people that I may or may not have pinned against the wall and harangued for not listening to the Pilot TV podcast mentioned that their main reason for not doing so is because they didn't want me to spoil their TV shows.
Mm.
And while clearly just by talking about them, I naturally spoil your enjoyment of TV shows,
yes,
there is a strict no spoiler policy on the Pilot TV podcast. We do not spoil your shows. There is a section at the end called the Banshee segment, but that's for very old shows. But yes, no spoilers.
Okay.
Do not panic.
Okay.
You're in safe hands here.
But you are a spoiler in your own just
obviously you have
being.
To listen to me, and that will spoil many, many things in your life. Mm. But that aside, there are no plot spoilers.
Okay. And once again, please do check out some of our spoiler specials. There is now a whole array of them.
Yes.
Up on
where
the
we
site.
Spoil loads of films.
So many films.
Mm.
It's
plethora.
All there for you. Okay, so that is now it for this week's Empire podcast. But join us next week for more film related fun when we're going to be joined by a directorial double whammy, Paul Feig.
Oh.
Talking about Last Christmas.
M.
That's right. Save it. And talking about Le Mans 66, James Mangold.
G.
There you go.
Wow.
OMG indeed. What a lineup. But until then, thank you for joining us. It's goodbye from Nick. Thank you for joining us.
It has been a delight.
It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye. I'll be back. Unlike the Terminator franchise.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to reanimate George Romero to explain why reanimating dead actors is a terrible idea.
I'm telling CG James Dean that.
Tell him. He won't mind. Thanks all. Bye.